Questions? Questions? Okay, so for a long time we've had a list of forces, and heretofore kind of the idea was that we were going to look at the force equations and we're going to add up the forces on an object and to get the net force, and then we knew that the net force was equal to the mass times the acceleration. Often we would have constant acceleration, so we could use those chapter 2 equations to calculate, you know, say the velocity after the thing travels some distance. So in this chapter and in future chapters, we're going to be paying less attention to F equals ma and more attention to the idea of energy. So corresponding to these forces, we have values for potential energy and work. For the conservative forces, which turn out to be most of the forces in the universe, but not most of the forces on this list, what we have is that the work that's done is equal to the change in the kinetic energy, minus the change in the potential energy. And the potential energy has a relatively simple formula. So last time we spent a lot of time on gravitational potential energy, which was just mgh. So we can get a lot of energy if we have water that's 10,000 feet up. We can let that water fall down and we can generate electricity from that potential energy. We haven't done a lot, even though these equations have been in the book, for gravity at a general distance from the Earth's center. We haven't dealt with those equations much, but there is the potential energy that we have for gravity in general. Same thing with springs. We haven't really done much with springs. We've had this equation in the book. Today we'll spend a lot more time dealing with the potential energy of the spring, which turns out to be 1/2 kx squared. For these guys, there aren't equations for potential energy because in general they're not conservative forces. The normal force we don't have an equation for. We know that it adjusts so that the acceleration perpendicular to the surface is zero. The frictional force, as long as we don't have motion, static frictional force also adjusts, but it has some breaking point, some maximum amount of friction that it can produce. When we actually have motion between the two surfaces, then we have an equation for the frictional force. Since friction is usually fighting displacement, very commonly the force and the displacement will be in opposite directions, so the work that's going to be done is minus F dot delta x. For the normal force, because in order to do work we have to have a displacement that's in the direction of the force, and usually for the normal force the direction of the force is perpendicular to the displacement, so the cosine of 90 degrees is zero, so very often the normal force is doing zero work. Okay, so work is force times distance, approximately speaking. Kinetic energy is a simple definition, namely it's just 1/2 mv squared. Conservative forces are ones for which we can define a potential energy like that. You should think about that potential energy as an energy of position, and so it's giving you the ability to do work if you have lots of potential energy. You can convert your potential energy to work by letting the water run downhill, for example. Then we had the work kinetic energy theorem, which said if you add up the work done by all of the forces, you're going to get the change in the kinetic energy. And by change in, I mean final minus initial. Very commonly, a lot of the forces are conservative forces, and we can put the work to the other side of the equation. So minus potential energy on this side of the equation ends up being plus potential energy on that side of the equation. So we can say then the work done by the non-conservative forces is the change in the total energy, kinetic energy plus potential energy. Questions? Well, before we start talking about springs, let's kind of take some examples that we could have done last time and work them through. So here we have Tarzan swinging on a long vine, And he starts out with an angle of 37 degrees, and we're supposed to figure out what his speed is at the bottom. So what are the forces that are acting on Tarzan? Well, gravity, of course, and we've got a good equation for the potential energy of gravity. The string is acting on Tarzan too. But is the string actually doing any work? So if you think about it, the swing, so here's his swing, here's the tension force, that's going to be perpendicular to his displacement. So even though the tension is present, the work that the tension is doing is going to be zero. So the only things that are going to be doing work are gravity, which is a conservative force, so we can use conservation of energy. We can set the initial energy equal to the final energy. Okay, so here's kind of the setup. He's starting out here at an angle of 37 degrees, and so he has some potential energy because he has some height. When he goes through equilibrium, at least the way I've defined my coordinate system, is height is zero. So his initial energy, 1/2 mv squared, well, he's not moving. He has no kinetic energy to start with, but he does have some potential energy, mgh. In the final situation, we're supposed to calculate his kinetic energy, but his height is zero, at least the way I've defined the coordinate system. Since this is a conservative situation, the initial energy equals the final energy, so if I can figure out what the height is, I'll be all set. So the height is this distance, and there are kind of lots of ways to calculate it. Kind of my favorite way to calculate it is to realize, and it's, I think it's kind of an awkward way of doing it, that's the total length of the rope, same as this. We can calculate this segment by using our trigonometry. That's a side that's adjacent to the 37 degrees, so that piece of it is going to be L cosine of 37 degrees. And if I subtract that from the whole length of the string, I'll get what I want. That H is equal to L minus L cosine of 37 degrees. So if I plug and chug, what I've got here is mg, the length of the string, 1 minus cosine of 37 degrees. That's all going to equal the final energy, which is all kinetic energy. And notice that the mass cancels out, so it doesn't matter whether Tarzan or Cheetah is using this vine. They're going to have the same velocity when they reach the bottom. So if I just rearrange this a little bit, bring the two up to this side of the equation, I have 2GL, 1 minus cosine of 37 degrees. So of course the velocity is going to be the square root of all of that. So we know that g is 9.8. This problem says that L is 30 meters. So I can plug and chug, I can see my calculator, to get what his speed is when he swings through the bottom. Of course, when he swings up, exactly the opposite happens. So we expect him to end up at 37 degrees on the other side, assuming everything is conservative. Believe that. Try it again. Let's calculate the height, I guess, then I'll be happier. So I get his height change at about 6 meters. And so I've got that times 2 times 9.8 and square root it, and I get basically 11 meters a second. If you want to get it more accurate, I guess. three sig figs. Okay, so the second part of the problem says, what happens if he doesn't just start from rest, if he pushes off? So he has some initial velocity, which they tell us is 4 meters a second. So it basically doesn't change things. We still have this equation that the total initial energy, now a piece of it is kinetic and a piece of it is potential, has to equal the final kinetic energy. So if we write that equation down, what we've got is 1/2 the mass times his initial speed squared, which is 4, plus his potential energy, mgh, where h is 1 minus cosine of 37 degrees. That all has to equal his final kinetic energy. Once again, the masses cancel out. So the final velocity squared is going to be 1/2 of 4 squared plus g times L times 1 minus cosine of 37 degrees. And of course, we can get the velocity just by taking the square root of all of that. So 4 squared is 16, so this is going to be 8 plus 9 plus 9.8 times 30 times 1 minus cosine of 37 degrees. Can save ourselves a second by remembering that this thing is still the same initial height, the 16.05 meters. So we've got 6.05 and 9.8. And we want to add to that 8. Take the square root.
I don't. Multiply the side by 2.
Yes, thank you. I wasn't believing my answer. Okay, third time's the charm. So we've got 6.05, 9.8, and 8 added to that, twice everything, and then take the square root. And now I get 11.6 meters a second. So it's kind of surprising. A pretty big push-off doesn't lead to that much change in the final velocity, because most of his energy is coming from the descent, the 6 meter descent. Okay, so gravitational potential energy, in this case the only active works are ones for which we have potential energy, so we can use the initial energy is equal to the final energy. So the other problem, kind of from last time, here we have two blocks. I don't know if you can see it. This one's A, this one's B. And it's going to be, this guy is the heavier one, so we expect it's going to pull this guy uphill. But there's friction between C and D here. And they tell us what the coefficient of friction is. And we're supposed to figure out what the kinetic energy is of block A as it moves from C to D up this incline. And they tell us this incline is 37 degrees. Okay, so now we've got friction, so we don't have conservation of energy, but we can say that the change in the energy is the work done by friction, and the work done by friction is going to be the displacement, which is 20 meters, times the frictional force. So we need to get the frictional force, and that's going to be the kinetic coefficient of friction, which they tell us, times the normal force. But the normal force is not mg on an inclined plane, right? It's been reduced. So then it's back to free body diagrams in order to figure out what the normal force is, and then we can figure out what the frictional force is, and then we can figure out how much energy is going to be eaten up by that frictional force. Okay, so here's our incline. We're mostly concentrating to start on block A. What are the forces that are present? Well, we know that gravity is pushing it down. At the surface, there's a normal force that's pushing it up. And there's a frictional force, which is what we're out to calculate, that's going to be fighting it. And of course, there's also this tension force. And we're really just after the normal force. We could go back and calculate the acceleration of the system and work it the way we have, back in chapter 4. But you remember the clue was that 1, 2, 3 out of 4 things are square with a tilted coordinate system. So it's going to pay dividends to choose a coordinate system which is square with the majority of things. The one thing that's not square now is gravity, and we're going to have to break it up into its x and y components. There's kind of some tricky geometry that leads to that angle being the same as this angle. But once we've got that, this adjacent edge of mg can be calculated from trigonometry. It's going to be mg cosine of 37 degrees. There's no acceleration in the y direction, so the normal force has to be exactly canceling that component. So the normal force has to equal mg cosine of, well, let me just write it as theta for a more general case. And that's the sort of result that happens so frequently it should probably be on your cheat sheets. Should be a very familiar result. I remind you, we won't use it, but this force that's down the plane is mg sine theta. Okay, well, if that's the normal force, then the frictional force is the kinetic coefficient of friction times the normal force. And the work done by friction is negative, because the force and the displacement are in opposite directions, times the force times the 20 meters. Let me just call 20 meters d, the 20 meters that it goes up the plane. Okay, so the plan is to say that the work done by friction, the only non-conservative force, is equal to the change in the energy. And they actually are asking for the change in kinetic energy, but just for convenience, let's think about this thing being released from rest so that the initial kinetic energy is zero. And what we're out to find then is basically the final kinetic energy. So what's missing is the gravitational potential energy, which is, of course, the appropriate mass times g times the appropriate height. So if we're going to have heights, we have to have zero levels, and we're free to choose those anywhere we want. We don't have to choose them the same for each object. We can choose them separate. And at least to me, makes sense to choose the initial location of my heights to be wherever it started from. In that case, the initial potential energy is going to be zero because all of the heights are zero. So for the final potential energy, this guy has gone up 20 meters on a slant, and so his final height can be given to us by trigonometry. It's a side that's opposite 37 degrees, so it's going to be the hypotenuse times the sine of 37 degrees. Or, more generically, the distance times the sine of the angle. If this one goes sideways 20 meters, this one has to go down 20 meters. So the final potential energy is the increased potential energy of mass A and the decreased potential energy, the height is now minus D, the decreased potential energy of mass B. So the work done by friction has to give us the change in the total energy. So we've got the work done by friction minus mu k. They tell us what that is numerically. M, and I just wrote M, but this is the mass that's sitting on the plane, which is mass A, g cosine theta times d. That has to equal the final energy. Well, the final energy, everything is moving at the same speed because they are connected by a string. So we have 1/2 the total mass times V squared. So that's the final kinetic energy. And we have final potential energy, which we've just calculated is MA G D sine theta. MA went up the plane, MB went straight down, minus the initial energy, which we've conveniently chosen to be zero for everything. We released it from rest, and we called all our heights zero. Okay, so if we're interested in finding the final kinetic energy, all we have to do is move those potential energies to the other side of the equation. So we've got this negative work done by gravity. We've got what was a minus sign over here will become a plus sign over here. And what was a plus sign over here will be a minus sign on the other side of the equation. And if we want, we can factor out some things, although it's not going to make the calculation that much easier. You can notice that every term has a g times d. Oops, I dropped my MA. I think I did that right. Okay, so I'm not going to bother to crank out the number. So we have, in the first case, we had conservation of energy. There was no non-conservative force, so the initial energy equaled the final energy. In this problem here, we had frictional force eating up some of the energy. So the final energy was less than the initial energy. How much less? Exactly the amount of work, negative work, that was done by the frictional force. Okay.
I'm just wondering, when you were finding the 20 sine of 37 over there, which is the d times the sine of theta, what was the thought process behind that? Because I lost you at that point.
Yeah. So heights are what we care about, right? Vertical heights. And that's, if this thing started here, that's this leg of this right triangle.
Right.
We're just finding the height it went up.
Just the height it went up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because the height is going to enter into all of these equations for gravitational potential energy. So MA went up not as much as MB went down because it went up on a slant. More questions? So the plan is to work similar sorts of problems where the only thing that's new is we're going to have springs as opposed to just gravity. And all that does is add another type of potential energy, 1/2 kx squared, where x is how much the spring, has been stretched. And the setup for all these problems are going to be the same, right? The work done by all of the forces is equal to the change in kinetic energy, or we can just put the non-conservative forces on one side of the equation and put the total energy change on the other side of the equation. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about springs. You know that there are stiff springs and there are springs that are pretty stretchable. This little guy, put the biggest weight on and it stretches hardly at all. Whereas these other guys have pretty small weights and they stretch by a whole lot. So the stretchiness of a spring is parameterized by the spring constant, this value of k. So this is a constant called the spring constant that you can look up for your particular spring. And the bigger that number is, the stiffer that spring is. And the claim is that the potential energy that's associated with that spring can be calculated by just 1/2 the spring constant times the displacement squared. So let's think about that for a second. So we know that, let's look at a general situation. So here's a graph of the force versus some displacement. And let's say that this force, you know, has some particular form. How much work would it take to go from this initial position to this final position? Well, we know that the work is equal to the force times delta x, but what force do I use? Because the force is different between those two locations. So what I have to do is I have to break this up into lots of little pieces that are thin enough so that the force can be thought of to be approximately constant for each one of those segments. And of course, if I break it up into fine enough pieces, the force will change hardly at all. For any one of these little segments, the work is going to be the more or less constant force times delta x. And if you think about it, that's exactly the area that's enclosed by this little rectangle. So if I add just the base times the height. So if I add up the area from all of these things, what I find is that the work that's done is just the area under the force versus position curve. Now, more commonly, we're interested in the potential energy. And the potential energy is just minus the change in the, the work is just minus the change in the potential energy. So it's maybe a little bit trickier to say that the potential energy is minus the area under the force versus position curve. So let's think about our particular example of the spring. When I stretch a spring, so if I pull this spring down, the spring is pushing a force up. If I compress this spring, the spring is going to be pushing down. So the force is in the opposite direction of the displacement, and that's why there's this minus sign. It's saying that if x is positive, the force is in the minus x direction. And if x is negative, if you've compressed the spring, the force is in the plus x position. And of course, what that means for a graph is something like that, right? The slope of that curve is going to be minus k. And we can calculate the area under that curve. So all of that area is negative because it's all below the axis, but I can calculate it from the legs of this triangle, right? Base times the height times 1/2 should give me that area. So I've got a base that is x, I've got a force that is minus kx, and for a triangle there's an extra factor of 1/2. So this area is minus 1/2 kx squared. And what that means, of course, then is the potential energy is going to be plus 1/2 kx squared. So if you stretch a spring, it's going to be storing a lot of energy. The more the stretch, the more potential energy that is being stored in it. Well, you know I like these kind of stacked graphs. So let's think about force versus x and potential energy versus x. And what we've said is to go from force to potential energy, it's going to be minus the area under the curve. And take it, it's going to be no surprise that if we go the other way, it's going to be minus the slope. And you can see that because we know that the work is done is the force times delta x, and it's going to be minus the change in the potential energy. So if we just bring the delta x to the other side of the equation, we have the force is minus the rise over the run, which is exactly the slope. So if we see a potential energy curve, a pretty random potential energy curve, if we're at this location, the slope is negative, which says that there's a force that's pushing you that way. If we're at this location, the slope is positive, which says that there's a force that's pushing you that way. And that's exactly how it would work if that potential energy curve were like a ski slope, right? If we're on this piece of the slope, gravity would be pulling us down. If we're on this side of the slope, gravity would be pushing us the other way. And you can interpret potential energy curves in exactly that fashion. You can think about them as topography, and you'll get the right answer of which way things are going to be pushed. So I hope you can imagine that something could sit here and just go back and forth in this valley that is some potential energy valley. And that's exactly what's happening when these springs oscillate, something that we won't come back to for a long time. Okay. So we've got a new stack of things, and we've got some kind of unhappy minus signs. Potential energy is minus the area under the force versus position. If we look at the slope of potential energy, minus that is going to give us back the force. And we've got a new equation for a type of potential energy, namely potential energy that's stored in a spring. And pretty obviously, the more stretched the spring is, the more energy that's being stored in that spring. Questions? So, let's put some sort of ski slope on here. So what I claim is that at this location, the slope is negative, which means that the force is going to have some sort of positive value. At this location here, the slope is zero, so the force has to be zero. At this location here, the slope is negative. Yeah, good. The slope's positive, which means that the force is going to be negative. And we could kind of connect the dots, at least in this vicinity, and see that the force has to look kind of like that. Now, I don't want to go too far, because here again, the slope is zero, so this force has to come back and be zero at that location. Here we have a positive slope, which means we've got a negative position. So those of you who have taken calculus recognize derivatives and integrals. That's not going to be part of this course exactly. And it can get, I don't know if this is the right time to confuse you or not. I guess I put it away because I didn't think that it would be good. But now, since I mentioned it, I might as well bring it out, I guess. Yeah. So here's kind of a crazy potential energy curve. And I hope you can see that you ought to be able to oscillate in this region, but if we were on this ski slope, we're going out this way. And if we put on top of this what the force is, so maybe before I do this, we should get ready for this. So here we're going to have a positive slope, so we're going to have a negative force. And here we've got a negative slope, so we're going to have a positive force. So in this vicinity, the force is going to look kind of like that, right? It's going to be going down. And I can line these things up. Yeah. Now, the the whole thing's twisted, but you can see here that here's the force. It goes through zero at this point, and it's going negative at that point. Okay, so here again, the slope is zero, the force is zero. I don't know, potentially more confusing than helpful. More questions? Okay, so let's take a look at some of these particular spring problems. So you can see that when I put a mass on one of those springs, it stretches by a certain amount. Can we use that to actually calculate what the spring constant is? So here we have, we add a 2.5 kilogram object, and we get 2.76 centimeters of stretch, and we're supposed to figure out what the spring constant is of the spring. So if we think about this in terms of the omnipresent free body diagrams, for one of those masses that's hanging, it's not going anyplace. We know it's being pushed down by gravity, so it must be being pushed up by the spring force. The magnitude, not the direction, the magnitude of the spring force has to be k times the distance that the spring has stretched. And since these things are in equilibrium, the force up has to equal the force down. So the spring force has to equal the weight, and so the spring constant is going to be mg divided by d. So we've got, in this particular case, 2.5 kilograms. We know that g is 9.8 meters per second squared. And we know we better convert those centimeters into meters. So we've got 0.0276 meters. So plug and chug. So we got 2.5, 9.8, 0.0276 divided by it, and I get 888. What are our units? Well, we like to think of the units of K as being newtons per meter, because then we can see how the units work in this equation. The meters of the distance and the meters in the denominator are going to cancel out. If we think about what this is a kilogram meter per second squared divided by a meter. So it's a kilogram divided by second squared. So you could use those units if you wanted to, but it seems a little bit more descriptive to be talking about newtons per meter. So if we adopt the latter, I hope you can see kilogram meter per second squared in the numerator, and of course meters in the denominator. So we're all set. If we only put half as much mass, we don't have to do a calculation, right? Everything's linear. It's going to stretch half as much. If we put twice as much weight on it and it doesn't break, it's going to stretch twice as much. Right? So all we have to do is divide that in two, right? 1.38, I guess. that's how much it's going to stretch with half the weight. How much work must an external agent do to stretch the same to stretch the spring by 8 centimeters? So this is, there's maybe a slightly interesting sign problem in this. So how much work would the spring do in order to stretch by 8 centimeters? We know that the work that the spring does is minus the change in the potential energy, and we've got more potential energy at the end than we have at the beginning, so this is going to be some negative number. On the other hand, there's an external agent that's pulling it down, and we know there's no change in the kinetic energy, right? It started at rest and it ended at rest. So the total work, the work plus of the spring plus the work of the external force, that has to add up to zero. So the work done by the external force has to be minus the work done by the spring, and that's equal to the change in the plus the change in the potential energy, and that's going to be 1/2 k the 8 centimeters, of course converted to meters, minus the initial stretch, which is zero. Yes? For sure. Yep. So if you pull any of these things, they go beyond what's called the elastic limit, and then they don't return to their original situation, and things are changed forever. These sort of practical springs also have a phenomena that's maybe worth talking about, and that is to say, if I stretch this, I get a force that's proportional to the pull, but you know, I can't actually compress it. So this ideal model we have for a spring has a somewhat limited range of possibilities. For lots of springs, I'm not sure I see one, here's one. This guy works both well in compression and in expansion. Right, I can compress it and I can expand it. But for any spring, there's going to be some limited amount that she's not going to come back afterwards.
Is there a way to figure out what that is, or is that a question we would be asked?
Not this month. So we'll eventually talk about elastic limits and things like that, strength of materials, but not for quite a while. So currently we're dealing with ideal springs that can stretch a light year and still don't break. More questions? Yes?
In that, what is Wx? I'm sorry.
So in order to stretch a spring, we need an outside force. So that's the work done by the external force. And that's actually what the problem asks us, not the work that the spring did, which is negative, since the displacement is in the opposite direction of the force, but the work that the external force did. And what has to be the case is the total work is zero because there's no change in the kinetic energy of the system. It started at rest and it ended at rest.
And so in this case, do we know what Wx is?
Yes. Right, because we now, in this last equation, we know everything, right? We've calculated the K from here, and we know the 8 centimeters. Won't actually hurt to do it if I can find my calculator. It's hiding over here. Okay, so we've got our K, which is basically 900. We've got half of that. And then we've got our 8 centimeters, which I convert to meters and square it. And what I get is 2.84. And if I walk away, I'm going to lose a point, right? So what's the units? Say again? Very good. Newton meters. But we always name things for famous dead physicists. So this gives you full credit. Nothing wrong with that. But very commonly, a Newton meter will be called a joule. You may also be familiar, maybe from chemistry. I don't know, are they still using calories in chemistry? Okay. Right. Is it 4.184 joules in a calorie? And you can remember that it's a kilocalorie is what a food calorie is. More questions?
So it was better to rate it as a duel?
You get same number of points for either one. So I have a slight I will not exactly the same number of points. But I personally have a slight preference for Jewel, but it doesn't matter. More questions? Okay, so that's kind of the easy plug and chug sorts of problems. So here we have a more complicated problem. We've got pulleys and masses, and they're telling us that M1 weighs more than M2, so we know what's going to happen is that M1's going to go down. When it goes down, it's going to stretch this spring. And they say that we're going to release this system from rest, and we're supposed to find an expression for the maximum expansion displacement, D of M2. And of course, they're connected by string, so however much this one goes up, this one goes down. Now, it's kind of important to recognize a difference between the maximum displacement and kind of the equilibrium displacement. So if I take one of these guys, well, this might be an awful lot. So this is an uncompressed spring, and if I drop it, I had a maximum displacement that was huge. Eventually, it'll come to rest at a different location where it has a force balance, an equilibrium sort of situation. But they're asking for the maximum. So when it's been going down and is now going up, when it has that instantaneous velocity, that's what we're supposed to find. And of course, if the velocity of the system instantaneously is zero, then the kinetic energy of the system is zero. So what we have then is 100% potential energy. Notice that there are no frictional forces in this problem, so we can use what, to my taste, is a slightly simpler idea, namely of energy conservation, that the initial energy is exactly equal to the final energy. Okay, so we've got gravity, so we've got mgHs. Where's the zero for H? And the answer is any place you want. You can choose it any place you want. You might as well choose it to be convenient to you. And to me, what the most convenient possibility is that the initial situation has height zero every place. So even if these guys in this picture show to be at the same height, but there's no reason I can't, if this guy were down here initially, I could still choose the height of it to be zero at its location and the height of this guy to be zero at this location. So just as with free body diagrams, we can choose our coordinate system separately for each object of interest. Okay, so what's the initial energy then? So the initial energy is made out of kinetic energy. It's made out of gravity potential energy, and it's made out of spring potential energy. But by design, all of those are zero, right? It's not moving. I made my heights be zero the way it was initially, and the spring is unstretched. So that means that the final energy also has to be zero. So what's the final energy going to be? Well, it's again going to be made up out of kinetic energy, gravitational potential energy, and spring potential energy. But once again, by the design of the problem, the system is at rest, so there's no kinetic energy. So I don't know, there are a lot of zeros in this problem. What we see is that the gravitational potential energy in the end, which I hope it's clear better be negative, has to add with the spring potential energy, which is always going to be positive, to give me zero. So let's kind of think this through. We've got M1, we've got M2, and we've got this spring. So this guy is going to fall some distance, let me call it D. This guy is going to rise exactly the same distance, D, and this spring is going to stretch by exactly the same distance, D. This guy's height is minus D, right? It's fallen by D. this guy's height is plus d, and the stretch, usually we've been calling that x, is going to equal d. So this final gravitational potential energy is going to be the mgh of m1, so that's m1g times its height, plus mgh of the other one. And the spring is going to have potential energy that is 1/2 kd squared. And that all has to add up to zero because the initial energy was zero. And the initial energy was mostly zero because I decided to take my heights to be zero in the initial state. And of course, it was started at rest. Okay, so our final equation then is the initial energy, which is zero, has to be m1g minus d plus m2g times plus d plus 1/2 k d squared. And I think it'll pay to factor this equation. It's a quadratic equation currently, and we could solve it using the formula for quadratic equations, but it seems overly complicated. If we just factor this guy, pull out all of the d's, what we've got is minus m1g plus m2g plus 1/2 kd. So there are two ways that this thing can be zero. One way is to have d be zero, right? If the initial situation is literally the same as the final situation, it's certainly going to work. The other way it can be zero is if this term is zero. If the product of two numbers is zero, one of them has to be zero. So if this thing equals zero, we have minus m1g plus m2g plus 1/2 kd equaling zero. Let's take the g stuff over to the other side of the equation. So we're going to have, and let me factor at the same time. Oops, mistake. The m1 will come over as a plus sign, and the m2 will come over as a minus sign, which I hope is clear. This thing is only going to work if m1 is more than m2. That's the only case we're going to get stretching. So I better have it in that order. So the distance it's going to stretch is going to be 2 over k, the difference in masses, times g. And this is a problem where we don't have numbers, we just have letters. So I have found an expression for the maximum displacement, d. Questions?
Why do we take the d down there?
Well, we didn't have to. So what we have here is a quadratic equation. And you can solve it as a quadratic equation, right, where this is the a coefficient, and all of this stuff is the b coefficient, and the c coefficient is zero. That'll work. There's nothing wrong with doing it that way. But a faster way of solving quadratics, if it works, is to factor it. Because then if I express something as the product of two numbers, right, if I have x times y equals zero, then either x or y has to be zero. So it's just a way of finding the roots of the quadratic without actually using the quadratic formula. Trickery. More questions? Okay, we've got a, you know, your typical toy gun, and it's going to throw something out that weighs 5.3 grams. Remember, we're going to have to change that to kilograms. And we're told that the spring constant is 8 newtons per meter, which is actually a pretty wimpy spring. The geometry, I think, is a little bit tricky to understand. The barrel of the gun is 15 centimeters long, and the spring is going to be compressed 5 centimeters. So kind of the picture is, so here's the gun barrel. So the spring has a natural length that would go to there, but that spring has been compressed. So now the bullet is there, and the full length of this barrel is 15 centimeters. So we're supposed to figure out the speed that the projectile leaves the barrel with that much compression. And they tell us that there's friction. When the bullet goes down the barrel, there's going to be this 32 thousandths of a newton worth of frictional force. So we can't use conservation of energy the way we did previously. We have to go back to the somewhat more complicated story that instead of the change in the energy being zero, the change in the energy is going to be the total work done by the non-conservative force. And that non-conservative force is going to be this force of friction, which is pushing it backwards. Because the force is in the opposite direction of the displacement, the work that's being done by friction is going to be negative, and it's going to be minus the frictional force times the distance, let me call it d, that the thing travels. Right? So the d is the 15 centimeters, and the f is this 0.032 newtons. So what's the final energy? In the final state, the spring has its normal length, so there's no potential energy stored in the spring anymore, but the ball is now moving at some speed. So all of the energy in the final state will be kinetic energy. In the initial state, the bullet is at rest, and so it has no kinetic energy, but there is potential energy, 0.05, converting it to meters, in the compressed spring. So in this equation, they tell us what K is, it's equal to 8. We know everything except the final kinetic energy. And remember that kinetic energy and velocity are very closely related. So typically, if you know one, you know the other. So we can figure out the exit speed from the final kinetic energy. Well, let's rearrange this a little bit. So the final kinetic energy, this has a minus sign in front of it, so it's going to come over to this side with a plus sign. So that's the potential energy that's stored in the spring. We have a certain loss of energy due to the frictional force. So we're all set then to calculate the final kinetic energy. So we've got half of 8 and I hope it's right, 5.2 times 10 to the minus 3 joules. And of course that has to equal the mass, 5.3 times 10 to the minus 3 kilograms times the final velocity squared. So the velocity squared is going to be 2 times this energy, all divided by this 5.3. And we can just take the square root of that to get the exit speed. And let me see if I got the same thing here. Yes. I hope you can see that these things kind of cancel out, so we end up with a square root of 2, which is 1.414. So kind of no surprise that we get 1.4 meters per second for a final speed. Okay, so in some sense, there's nothing new. We just have a new form of potential energy, 1/2 kx squared, in order to put into our energy equations. Well, so here we have a general graph of force versus displacement, and they're going to ask us to calculate the work. And we ought to calculate the work, right? It's the area under the curve. So it's just a matter of figuring out all of these various areas. And when we figured out the work, we'll be able to figure out what the change in kinetic energy is, because they ask us about that too. So starts out asking us how much work is done as we go from 0 to 5 meters. And if I just cut this off at 0 to 5 meters, we've got a perfect triangle. So the area under that curve, so this is 0 to 5, the area under that curve is going to be the base, which is 5 meters, times the height, which is 3 newtons, times 1/2 for a triangle. So we've got 1/2 of 15, 7.5 newton meters, or famous dead physicist, joule. How about we go from 5 to 10? So here's 5 and here's 10. What we've got there is a rectangle. And the base of that rectangle is from 5 to 10. It's 5 meters. And the height of that rectangle is 3 newtons. So we've got 15 joules. And this final downward triangle is the same as the initial triangle, just flipped around. So the area under it is going to be the same as the area of the first. Okay, so they say if the object started out having a speed of 1/2 of a meter per second, we're supposed to find its speed at various other locations. And here we're using the work kinetic energy theorem. The work done is the change in the kinetic energy. So if we're talking about from 0 to 5, the work done is the 7.5 joules. That has to equal the final kinetic energy minus the initial kinetic energy. And they say that this thing weighs 3 kilograms, and it was moving at 1/2 a meter a second. So the final kinetic energy is going to be the energy that was put in by the force plus the energy that was there initially in motion. And of course, once we've got our kinetic energy, it's going to be easy to get our final velocity. So we got 7.5 and we got 3/8. So this is 7.875 joules. And if we actually want to get the speed out, this is 1/2 the mass times the velocity squared. So we're going to have 2/3 of the 7.875 square rooted is going to be the velocity. Is that okay? It's a little bit fast.
Where did 2/3 come from?
So The 2 is the usual 2 from 1/2, and the 3 is the particular value of mass in this circumstance. And I get 2.29 meters per second. I think we'll skip over the rest of that problem. Take a look at 66 here. So we're going to dump this ball, which has a mass of 1.8 kilograms, from 65 centimeters, that's a pretty good fall, onto this spring. And we're supposed to assume that there are no non-conservative forces, so that energy is conserved. And the spring is going to be compressed by 9 centimeters. It'll probably bounce around a little bit after that, but we're just supposed to figure out the speed at the maximum compression. Okay, so no non-conservative forces. So we're in the situation where the initial energy equals the final energy. In the initial state, the object is released from rest, so there's no kinetic energy. In the final situation, the object is instantaneously at rest as it reaches its maximum compression. Right? A millisecond before that, it was going down. A millisecond after that, it was going up. Right at maximum compression, it has zero speed. So what we've got then is initial energy equals final energy. So we've got zero kinetic energy, and we've got some potential energy, which is mgh. What I choose for h is up to me. Where are we going to choose the zero for h? Any preferences? Well, I'm going to choose it to be at the uncompressed height of the spring, basically because that's what the problem is set up to tell me. But a not unreasonable choice would be to choose it to be zero initially, and then all of these heights are going to be negative in the future. But the way they've set it up, most of these heights, or at least this height, is going to be positive, namely 65 centimeters. The final energy, again, the kinetic energy is zero because things are instantaneously at rest. And we have gravitational potential energy of mgh. And kind of a classic mistake is to say that the height is zero. Right? It's not. The height is now minus 9 centimeters. And then we have potential energy in the spring. 1/2 k times the x squared, where this x is the 9 centimeters. So they tell us the mass, they've told us the height, they've told us the distance. The only thing we don't know in this equation is the spring constant. And that's exactly what they ask us to calculate, I think. It's part, yeah. So the first part, the speed of the ball before it touches the spring, that's actually a chapter 2 question, right? We have constant acceleration of g, so we could use the final velocity squared as the initial velocity squared minus 2g times delta y and figure out what that final speed was. Or we could use conservation of energy. But in any case, I think that's the simpler question. Part B, asking us for k, that's also not particularly difficult. So, I don't know, we might as well plug and chug. So the mass is 1.8. We know that g is 9.8. So on the top side of the equation, we have 1.8 times 9.8. Convert the centimeters to meters. That has to equal the mass times g times the height, which is minus 0.09. plus 1/2 k times 0.09 squared. So we bring this term over to this side of the equation. Can do a little bit of factoring. So finally, k is going to be 2 times 1.8 times 9.8. times the whole total distance of fall divided by 0.09 squared. And I think I did that and I got 3.22 times 10 to the minus 2, excuse me, 3.22 times 10 to the third newtons per meter. Okay, so quiz like the other quizzes, expect springs and conservation of energy.
Yes. Because it's right before the
What did you say?
I said you should put bonus points on there. So I have more long weekend.
Yeah. Could do these sorts of questions.
Sure.